Hello, and welcome to Sentencing Practice Talk, a podcast for federal sentencing practitioners presented by the U.S. Sentencing Commission. In this episode, my colleagues Lori Baker and Peter Madsen discuss a common helpline question, that of relevant conduct. Lori and Peter review the importance of order, common misconceptions, the rules for assessing jointly undertaken criminal activity, and much more. Without further ado, here's Lori and Peter.
Hey, Pete.
Hey, good afternoon, Lori. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing today?
Oh, it's been a Monday, but I'm looking forward to this.
It sure has. So our topic today is relevant conduct. One of my, one of my favorite topics. I'm not sure that that's actually accurate. I think it's such a difficult topic to talk about. And we don't have time to talk about all of the aspects of relevant conduct in one podcast session, but I think we're going to tackle a little bit. What do you want to talk about today, Pete?
Yeah, I mean, this can be a two-hour podcast or like a 15-minute podcast, and I think I'm going to err on the side of the 10 to 15 minutes. And I think if we focus more on maybe what we get a lot of questions about relevant conduct, like when there's conspiracies, you know, whether it's a fraud conspiracy, a drug conspiracy, or alien smuggling, you know, we have to kind of determine who's responsible for what, and maybe that's a good idea or a good topic for today.
Yeah, I think you're right. So I hear you talking about jointly undertaken criminal activity. So when there's more than one person involved in an offense, then we've got to make that individualized determination to determine who's responsible for what conduct, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a, I don't know if it's a misnomer or not, but I think sometimes when people see there's, you know, five people charged with a conspiracy, you know, everybody eats everything. And I think the important takeaway from today is that's not necessarily the case.
Okay, so what's the best way to talk through this? I think we probably ought to start by the basic rules for assessing jointly undertaken criminal activity.
Right. I think that's a good starting point. I think when we're talking about jointly undertaking criminal activity, we really got to focus on the acts and omissions of other people. And there's always three questions we have to ask ourselves. Number one, what were the acts or omissions of the others that were within the scope of the jointly undertaken criminal activity? Were the acts of others in furtherance of that criminal activity? And was it reasonably foreseeable in connection with that criminal activity? And before we get into the weeds, I just want to make sure that everybody fully understands that you really have to do this analysis in order. You can't just jump to, well, I'm sure it's reasonably foreseeable, which might very well be the case, but that's not the correct analysis. I think we really want to start with the defendant's scope, then work on whether or not it was in furtherance, and then finally, if it's reasonably foreseeable.
So let's just, before we dig into maybe an example to kind of walk through this, can we talk a little bit more about what these terms mean? So you started with what is the scope of the jointly undertaken criminal activity? To me, that means what did these people agree to do, right?
Exactly. And I mean, this could be explicit agreements. It could be implicit agreements. So whether, you know, they're on Title III wiretaps or they're text messages or emails or, you know, just a conversation amongst the conspirators, I think that's the most important question we have to ask ourselves first. Is what was their scope? What did they agree to do?
Okay, so that's question one. What did they agree to do? Question two was the activity of the other person in furtherance of the criminal activity? And then we get to that reasonably foreseeable. Was that conduct reasonably foreseeable? And that doesn't necessarily mean reasonably foreseeable to the person whose conduct we're looking at. It means reasonably foreseeable to an ordinary person, right?
Exactly. And I think that's the important part, too, is what would the reasonable person assume or capture in that analysis?
Okay, so now we know what we're talking about for those three parts. How are we going to make that determination, Pete?
Well, there's two ways we can do that. I think, number one, I just want to give you maybe an overview of a quick example kind of relating to a drug conspiracy. And then I think we maybe walk through like an alien smuggling or unlawful alien smuggling case. So when I look at it, if we're talking about the relevant conduct being different for each defendant. So say you have multiple people involved in a drug conspiracy. One guy, he drives his car from California all the way to Minnesota. Maybe he does that on two occasions over a period of 1 month. Then you have a separate guy who, you know what, he's got an airplane. So he's actually flying from California to Minnesota. Maybe he does it like 10 different times in a period of 6 months. Their scope and duration are not the same. These two individuals' relevant conduct will, in fact, be vastly different.
So, you know, I think where my brain automatically goes, and I think can be a difficult point for people, is in trying to parse out what those people are responsible for. In that example that you just gave, it's easy to say, but everybody knew what was going on. They all knew that there was this conspiracy and that this guy was flying drugs and these people were driving drugs. So they should all be held accountable for the whole thing.
Right. And I think that goes back to one of the rules we have in 1B1.3. I believe it's application note 3B, where you can't consider the conduct of members of a conspiracy prior to the defendant joining that conspiracy. Even, as you said, the defendant might be aware of that additional criminal conduct. We have this bright line rule. Until you do something, you know, illegal in that conspiracy itself, you can't hold them accountable for that criminal behavior.
So you're also saying that you can't be held accountable for what you know, right?
Exactly.
So just the fact that you know that this criminal conduct is going on, you're not held accountable until you've actually done something to participate.
That is exactly true.
All right. So you wanted to talk about maybe an alien smuggling case.
Sure. So let's look at a unlawful alien smuggling case. We'll try and make this simple. I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but basically we got three defendants. You got one defendant. He charges $1,500 per unlawful alien to be smuggled in the United States. Maybe over a period of 1 or 2 years, he smuggles 100 aliens into the United States. The second smuggler is another guy. He's getting paid roughly $200 for every alien he smuggles, but he's only made 2 trips, maybe a total of 10 aliens, 5 on each trip. However, on that last trip, he gets caught speeding. He sees law enforcement behind it, and he takes off. He's fleeing from law enforcement at a high rate of speed. He crashes, and unfortunately, one of the aliens dies in the car wreck. Then the third guy, he's a guy that lives at a stash house, we'll just say in El Paso, Texas. He's holding the aliens there until either they pay up or someone else comes to pick him up. When that guy gets arrested at the stash house, he's got a gun on his person. So now the question is, you know, number one, who's responsible for what, right? I mean, I think that's the biggest determination we have to make, at least from the get-go.
So there's a lot going on there with those three defendants in this example that you've given us. What are the major issues that we need to think about as we get started with this process?
Right. If you're in the 2B, oh man, I'm in the wrong guideline, the 2L1.1 guideline, we talk about alien smuggling. There's a lot of different specific offense characteristics. We have number of aliens, we have firearms possession, we have reckless endangerment, and at least in this case, based upon the injuries, we have death that happened as a result of, you know, fleeing from law enforcement at a high rate of speed. So we've got a lot of specific offense characteristics that probably don't apply to every single defendant.
All right, so where do you want to start? Should we start with defendant number one?
Sure. Let's start with defendant number one. And we talk about scope, right? What did he agree to do? And I think when you have a single defendant, you know, that analysis is pretty easy. But when you talk about this individual, basically he's involved in a smuggling operation, right? He's getting $1,500 per unlawful alien, and he smuggles over 100 aliens into the United States. You know, that's all we have for that individual smuggler.
So do we think he's going to be held accountable for that other conduct, the other individual smuggled, and then that flight from law enforcement that results in a death?
And I don't think so. I mean, you talk about his scope is very limited. He knows over the period of those 2 years, he's smuggling 100 aliens in the United States. You know, were his acts in furtherance and were they reasonably foreseeable? We really don't have any information to suggest that he's connected with the other smuggler or even the individual living at the stash house in El Paso. So I think his scope is just limited to his own involvement.
Okay, what about smuggler number two? Now, this is the smuggler who gets paid $200 per alien, and he's made two trips for a total of 10, but he gets involved in that high-speed chase.
He gets involved in the high speed chase, so there's a whole bunch of SOCs or specific offense characteristics. Certainly, the potential for a number of aliens. We have this reckless endangerment, and then we also have the injury. In this case, the most serious injury, the death that results. You know, his scope is limited to the transporting of those specific number of aliens, 10, five on each trip. So his relevant conduct is going to look a lot different than the first defendant.
So he's not responsible for anything that happened with the first guy that brought in 100 aliens, right?
Correct.
Okay, and what about the third guy at the stash house?
Right, the third guy, he has nothing to do with the aliens being smuggled either by the first defendant or the second defendant. He's just an individual at a stash house in El Paso. He has a firearm on his person. I'm assuming that's for his own protection or to ensure that the unlawful aliens don't flee or take off. So when you talk about his scope, you know, what is his role? His role is to manage the stash house and make sure that they pay up and that, you know, they don't leave. So by having that firearm, that's probably help facilitating his criminal behavior.
So for this person, is he going to be held accountable for the 100 aliens that the first defendant brought in, or the 10 aliens, the high-speed chase, the death that the second defendant is involved in?
Right. And we don't have any information to suggest that he's necessarily connected with the other smugglers, right? I'd be curious to know, and we don't necessarily know in this set of facts, like how many aliens are at the house when he gets arrested. We don't necessarily know how they're all connected. But when you talk about his scope is definitely limited to holding the aliens that were brought to him, how many ever that might be. Potentially, there's a chance that it could be the aliens from the first defendant and also the second defendant, but you definitely need to walk through that analysis to see whether or not that's applicable or not.
So it sounds to me like after we've applied the analysis to these three defendants, none of them are being held accountable for the conduct of the others, right?
Exactly. And I think even though they might all have been charged with conspiracy to smuggle unlawful aliens in the United States, that's one part of it, right? Sentencing liability is not the same as criminal liability, right? And so I think when you walk through that relevant conduct analysis and walking through, you know, what was the defendant's scope, were the acts of others in furtherance, and is it reasonably foreseeable, I think you can make an argument that you really have three separate defendants who are actually going to be, whose guideline calculations are going to be pretty different from one another.
I think one of the really important points that you're making is that, again, you've said it a couple of times, just because people are charged in a conspiracy doesn't mean that they're all responsible for everything that happened in that conspiracy. So we've shown here with these three different defendants that they each played a different part, a different role in that conspiracy, but they really had nothing to do with each other, in order to be held accountable for one another's conduct for guideline application purposes.
Exactly. And I think it's so important that every case is very fact specific. And you could have potentially a conspiracy where everybody is, you know, communicating with one another, you know, which aliens are you bringing to the house today? And oh my God, I can't believe one of them got in a car crash and died. But I think walking through the analysis will certainly make the relevant conduct determination a little bit easier rather than just assuming that everybody gets every SOC or Chapter 3 adjustment.
Yeah, and the other point I'd like to make is that there's a misconception sometimes that relevant conduct really broadens the conduct for which an individual is held accountable. And that does happen. There are times when you're held accountable for the acts of another person, but just as often, that relevant conduct analysis is going to narrow the scope. It's going to limit what you can apply. But again, as you've emphasized, you really need to walk through that process to know whether you can bring it in or not.
Exactly. That's a good point to make.
All right. Anything else that we want to mention on jointly undertaken criminal activity today?
When in doubt, submit a question to the helpline. We do get a ton of questions about unlawful alien smuggling, especially when there's injuries and, you know, maybe there are people at a stash house. Are they going to be held accountable for the injuries of the alien that's being brought there? And I think it really does spur a lot of questions, no doubt.
We do. I say all the time that all roads lead to relevant conduct, and maybe not all roads, but most roads in guideline applications somehow connect to that relevant conduct analysis. So it's super important, and it can be really difficult. Some of those helpline questions that we get are really hard to work through to make that analysis. But we also have a lot of resources on the website for relevant conduct. We've got an e-learning course on basic relevant conduct. We've got a primer that gets updated annually. We've got some one-page resources with kind of a summary of these types of rules. So please reach out to us if you have a question or if you'd like us to point you to any of those resources. And we look forward to talking to you again next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Sentencing Practice Talk. Be sure to subscribe if you haven't already to the podcast on iTunes or Spotify to stay up to date. If you've got a question for the helpline or want to access any of the resources discussed in this episode, you can find us at ussc.gov. A reminder that registration for the 2025 National Seminar on the Federal Sentencing Guidelines in Salt Lake City from August 19th to 21st is now open. Visit our website for more details. Please be advised that the information provided by Commission staff is offered to assist in understanding and applying the sentencing guidelines. The information does not necessarily represent the official position of the Commission, should not be considered definitive, and is not binding upon the Commission, court, or the parties in any case. This episode was produced and published at taxpayer expense. That's all for now. Thanks for listening.